Good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Today is Monday, March 8th, 2021. I'd like to thank Carrie and Doug, who are our recording secretary and LIO operator. Thank you for making this meeting possible. It's exactly 1:30, and with me this afternoon is Vice Chair Senator Holland. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
And Senator Stevens, welcome.
Thank you.
And Senator Rivak will be with us shortly, and I believe Senator Gray Jackson will also, so we look forward to having them join us. Today we have essentially three items on our agenda. We're going to start out by considering three governor's appointees to the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers. Welcome, Senator Gray Jackson. And then following that, we will have the first hearing of Senate Bill 27, an act relating to industrial hemp. That was introduced by Senator Hughes, and her aide is here. Welcome, buddy. And then Senate Bill 87, which was introduced by the Senate Rules Committee on behalf of the governor, an act relating to credit for reinsurance. This is the first hearing in this committee, and we have the director of the Division of Insurance with the Department of Commerce here, Lori Winghire. Thank you for being here. She will be providing invited testimony. We will be holding both of those bills for further consideration. So with that, I see we have our three governor's appointees waiting patiently online. If you could introduce yourself to the committee and explain to us your background briefly, and then let us know why you're interested in serving on the committee. And I'm also interested in knowing from you any challenges that you see the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers will be facing as we make our way out of COVID and into a period of recovery. So with that, I would like to first invite Kitsana Sipakampai, who is the first appointee for the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers. Kitsana, if you could introduce yourself to the committee, please.
Hi, my name is Kitsana, and I would like to thank you for your consideration, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay. Kitsana, do you want to briefly go over your resume for us and then explain your interest in serving on this particular board?
Yes, so I started my career as a licensed hairdresser. I started at Trendsetters in 2004, and then I moved into permanent makeup tattooing in 2018, and that's where I'm at nowadays. I actually do that as a part-time. My full-time job is working with Alaska Airlines as a trainer, facilitator, and station support.
Wonderful. And I see from our material that you were appointed just last month. And I was curious, have you been attending any of the meetings?
I have not. I didn't know of any of the meeting, but I did look up the notes after. I thought that there was a meeting in the beginning of the year, and I was not present for that meeting. So I just looked over the notes that were from the minutes from that meeting.
Great. Are there any questions that committee members have for Kitsana? I actually have a question. So have you been practicing during the period of COVID, and have you had any observations or challenges that you've had to face as you've worked in under the COVID environment?
I have been working under the COVID environment, and I haven't found any challenges because I do work by myself, so I don't have that capacity issue because it's just me. And all of my clients understand the COVID procedures, and I do text them. When I text their confirmation date the day before, I also ask all the COVID questions, and I follow all the procedures that come with the whole process.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much for your willingness to serve on this board. I know that we have hundreds of Alaskans who serve on boards and commissions, and they do it essentially out of an interest in making our state a safe and better place, and I do appreciate you stepping up to serve. Is there anyone here who's or online who wishes to provide public testimony on the appointment of Kitsana Sipakampai for the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers? Okay, seeing none, we'll go ahead and close public testimony on this appointee. And feel free to stay and listen to the other members, since you'll be serving most likely with them on the board. Next, I'd like to invite Connie Doherty, who's also an appointee for this board, to introduce yourself to the committee and explain to us your background and why you're interested in serving on this board.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for your time and consideration. This is Connie Doherty. I own Cut Loose Salon in Anchorage. I have been a hairdresser since 1988 right here in Anchorage. I graduated from Trendsetters, and I taught there for a little while before moving on to go work for Ronald's Hair Design, and I stayed there for a few years, and then I opened up my first salon. And throughout the years, I have had various roles, mostly as an educator, is something I'm very, very proud of, teaching advanced techniques to other hairdressers, and taking on some apprentices in my salon and teaching them how to do hair and nails throughout the years. I haven't done that in a while, but I used to hold those licenses. And I just wanted to be on the board, especially after the big changes came last year. I know a lot of hairdressers, and some of the things that have come up, we just didn't pay that close of attention to until they were actually enacted into law, and we weren't crazy about them. So I thought this is a great time for me to get on this board and get more involved with the way that our hairdressers are being handled, maybe perhaps the rate at which the schools are pumping them out, how they're being tested. I'm hoping that maybe we can get some sort of continuing education in the guidelines for hairdressers moving forward. I think that's really, really critical that we all stay current and up to date. And I would just appreciate this opportunity to serve on the board.
Thank you, Connie. Do you happen to know how many licensed hairdressers and barbers and tattoo artists that fall under the board are actually licensed in Alaska?
I believe a rough guesstimate on my part is about 14,000.
Thank you. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Holland.
Thank you, Connie. I'll apologize because I got two challenges against me. One, I'm a guy, I'm a man, and so I don't get esthetician's duties that much or hairdresser job. Then anyone who knows me knows I don't spend a whole lot of my hair. So, I appreciate your interest in this board. Can you just tell me what were some of the regulations that you weren't crazy about that might have jumped out last year that's got you motivated?
The one that screamed at all of us was the removal of the practical examination before getting a license.
And that was pretty much it. That was the one outstanding one that you were pretty much dissatisfied with.
The huge one. The other one was a special license required for braiding.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Thank you, Connie. It's great to have motivated Alaskans who want to really look at these professions and ask the questions that you're asking regarding the regulations and what have you. So any other questions of committee members? Okay, seeing none, is there anyone here in Juneau or online that wishes to provide public testimony on Connie Doherty's appointment to the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers? Okay, seeing none, public testimony on this appointment is now closed. We have one final appointee, Tina Taylor. Welcome, Tina. If you could introduce yourself to the committee and provide a brief explanation of your background and also why you are interested in serving on this board, that would be great.
Hello, and thank you so much. My name is Tina Taylor, and I was raised here on the peninsula. I raised my family here. I'm a salon owner. I've been a licensed cosmetologist and stylist and manicurist. And I've also served my community as a Rotarian and volunteering and also giving to my local schools lots of donations through my business. I want to be on the board with my 33 years in the industry. I know I can represent my fellow professionals, and like Connie said, the main thing that got me was the practical examination. And that's kind of what threw me into putting my name in the hat. So I know I can represent the other professionals as well, because we are essential to the well-being of each of our communities. And my experience as a professional mixed with other surface-related jobs that I have done, I've had my CNA license, and I currently work in a care facility doing their hair there. And it means a lot for those people, too, to keep looking good. So our industry is widespread and touches a lot of people, and I think I can be a help with keeping the regulations and the concerns of my fellow professionals, because it means a lot when you've chosen a profession and then somebody starts taking away what it is and chipping away at what you do. So I just want to thank each one of you for your service to our great state, and thank you for this time and consideration.
Thank you, Tina. I appreciate you putting your name forward. Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and congratulations to Tina on being involved in Rotary and that idea of service above self. But I just wanted to mention, one thing that impresses me most are the names of the shops. They're always so clever. What is the name of your shop?
Hair Pros, Inc.
You guys must take a class in it. I saw one today downtown here called Hair Today. Hair Today and Gone Tomorrow. They're really clever names you guys choose. But anyway, thanks for your service to Rotary and to your community.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tina. Is there anyone here in Juneau or online who wishes to testify in regards to this appointee? Okay. Senator Holland?
Thank you, Tina, for getting involved. So the practical exam, it seems to be an issue. Can you just describe it? Is it actually is it a scored process, or is it I could imagine how involved it could be, even with bedside manner and how good you interact with the customers instead of just like cutting hair. But could you just go through some of the steps on a practical exam and what they might grade a person on?
Well, you literally are drawing out of a hat, but you know they still have us draw out of a hat, and you have to be prepared to teach the class that was there whatever you drew out of the hat. So it is broken down in different percentage of what your written exam was to what your practical is and how you yourself performed doing whichever one you drew out of the hat. So, like, it's a big deal to know how to start straightening someone's hair chemically or to put a chemical on for perming. And we have sanitation processes that have been taught from the get-go. So it is a big deal to know how to physically apply chemicals.
I can imagine. Thanks so much for your information.
Thank you, Tina. And is there anyone, I'll ask again, is there anyone online who wishes to testify in this appointment? Okay, great. Without anyone online, we'll go ahead and close public testimony on the appointment of Tina Taylor to the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers. And I want to again thank the three of you for making yourself available today for the committee. We will be moving your names forward through the process, and so we will take a brief at ease while we do that and then get our next bill ready for hearing. So again, thank you very much. We'll take a brief at ease. Hey, welcome back to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Next on our agenda is Senate Bill 27. I'd like to welcome Senator Hughes. This is your bill, along with your aide, Buddy Witt, who are here to explain the bill. This is an act relating to industrial hemp and providing for an effective date. It's the first hearing in committee. The intention is to have invited testimony and then hold it for consideration. Prior to hearing the bill, we do have a friendly amendment. Senator Holland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment number one, amendment 32-Lima Sierra 0249/alpha.1 to Senate Bill 27.
I'll object for the sake of discussion.
Madam Chair, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has a standard of negligence that they allow for the levels of Delta 9 tetrahydrocannabinol for products, and the standard of negligence is 0.5% to 1.0%, and this amendment just increases the changes the word shall from shall issue a stop order to may issue a stop order to allow the Commissioner of Natural Resources a little bit of latitude, because at the 0.3%, because of the seed stocks that hemp growers are allowed to purchase, they're very limited on the quality of a seed stock. That 0.3% is hard to hit, and oftentimes 0.3% means the grower has to destroy their entire crop based on one test. So this amendment just gives the Commissioner of Natural Resources a little bit of latitude to extend that 0.3% to follow more within federal guidelines.
Okay. So I'll go ahead and remove my objection to the amendment. Is there any further objection from committee members? Senator Stevens?
I'm sorry to object, but I just don't understand. I thought that there was no connection between marijuana and hemp. Maybe you can help me understand that.
Buddy, if you'd like to introduce yourself for the committee.
Thank you.
And the reason I say that is because it talks about notifying the Marijuana Control Board.
Thank you. Through the chair, for the record, Buddy Witt, staff to Senator Hughes. Thank you for the question, Senator Stevens. This particular piece of law was added in Senate Bill 6, and there is a, and I'll just go ahead and say right now, Rob Carter, the state agronomist from the Plant Materials Center, could probably speak to this more extensively. This provision was added, and there is hemp is basically the same plant, but it tests under the legal definition of it tests in an area that defines itself as not being not having the ability to get someone intoxicated. So what this basically does is it allows if someone is growing hemp, and we'll talk, it fits in with some other provisions of the bill. What it allows is some language for the Division of Agriculture to make management decisions for the growing of industrial hemp so that someone isn't automatically guilty of doing something. And good actors who are acting on good faith and trying to grow the hemp crop can be given the ability to recondition their crop. The language as it stands now is completely prohibitive from someone doing that without getting a stop sale order, without their name being turned in to the Marijuana Control Board and to the Department of Public Safety. And after discussions with the Division of Agriculture and the bill sponsor, we thought maybe some less prohibitive or less some language that allowed them a little bit more of ability to manage the program. This was added, as I said, in SB 6, and if it was the will of the committee to just delete that entire section of law, we certainly could do that, but we found this to be a middle ground to get us from where we are now to a long-lasting program. I don't know if I answered your question, and I would say that Rob Carter could actually add some more.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Stevens, did you have a follow-up question to that?
I guess what I understand then, Madam Chair, is that you'd have to smoke a lot of industrial hemp to have any impact. Is that right? Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead and let Senator Holland ask his question, and then
it was just a statement that hemp is more broadly used for products like hempcrete, making concrete from hemp. And I'm not a hemp expert, but and also animal food stock and items like that and it's just a fraction of the active ingredient that marijuana has in it. But.
Senator Hughes, did you want to weigh in on your bill?
Well, I just was going to add to what my chief of staff was saying for through the chair for Senator Stevens is, you know, you could have someone who thinks they have good seed and the Division of Ag thinks it's good seed and they have no ill intentions, and then it turns out it's maybe a little high in the THC. And reconditioning, basically they can mix it with a lower THC and then it comes within the appropriate range. So to immediately charge someone with as being a bad actor when that wasn't their intention, it gives them a chance to remedy the situation.
I see. And Madam Chair, I'll remove my objection then.
Okay. Is there any further objection to the amendment? All right. Seeing none, then amendment number one to Senate Bill 27 does pass. And now I'd like to turn over to the sponsor and her aide to walk us through the bill as amended.
Yes, and I'm just realizing, Madam Chair, I didn't put my name on the record when I made a comment before. So for that earlier comment and for the introduction of the bill, I am Shelley Hughes, and I represent Senate District F, which includes some agricultural land. And why I am sitting here today, I want to give you a little bit of history, a little bit of timeline. And I want to say I'm actually delighted to be in front of this committee. It's one of my favorites. I think it's a very key committee considering what our state is facing and our economy is facing and what we've learned about oil. And wherever we can find ways to diversify, we ought to go for it. So I thank you for the work that you do. It's really important right now in this particular point in time. But to back up and tell you why I'm here, it starts in 2014. A farm bill was passed at the federal level, which allowed the states to establish an industrial hemp pilot program. And so shortly thereafter, a year or two after that, Senator Johnny Ellis introduced a hemp bill that would remove it from the criminal statutes and make hemp a crop. And one of my very most conservative constituents, a farmer, contacted me because he wanted to try it for food stock for his cattle. And so it was toward the end of that session, late 2016, April. And so I worked with Senator Ellis, but it was just too much to get through before we closed out that session. And so he retired, and I committed to carry it on. And so that is how this came to be. Meanwhile, that summer, right after Senator Ellis and I couldn't quite get it over the finish line, the USDA put out outlined a path for how a state could have an industrial hemp program that would comply with law. So now fast forward to 2017, a new legislative session. So I file a bill, SB 6, and I work on it for 2 years. And that bill then passed at the end in April of 2018. Well, that's not the end, because then 8 months later, in December of that year, the federal government Congress passed the Hemp Farming Act as part of the 2018 Farm Bill. And that actually removed industrial hemp from the Scheduled I controlled substance list. And so in 2019, then the USDA released some regulations, and it said that states could continue their current pilot programs until October 30th, 2020. So that was last October. So now since then, they've updated that to this October of 2021. So we're facing a deadline, basically. And that's part of what brings me here today, is because of that 2018 Farm Bill and those updated regulations, we have to make some changes in our current statutes. And so what SB 27 basically does about four different things or so, and Buddy will tell you about a few more, but the main one is it removes the industrial hemp pilot program and now instructs and gives authority to DNR, the department, to develop a program that's compliant and to submit that program to the USDA for approval. And then it also gives the department the authority to permit manufacturing of hemp-related products and to set up a registration and renewal process for participation in that program. And it also instructs that a registrant may not have been convicted of a felony involving a controlled substance in the prior decade. And then it finally adds a couple cleanup provisions that Mr. Witt will review with you. I just want to state before I close is my druthers would have been that this growing this crop would not require a program and a bureaucracy and registration, et cetera, that we could have just simply made it as an ag crop. That's what Senator Ellis's bill had done. But what happens since that at the federal level, because of concerns, because the plant does look like marijuana, we have this extra framework that we need put in place in our state right now. But I will say, I still think it's worth the trouble, and I think it's worth doing. And the reason I say that is because hemp is a multi-billion dollar industry, and China is number one producer of hemp, and right behind that is Canada. And our climate is similar to Canada, so we do have a chance that this could take off. And having talked over the last few years to some of the folks at our Division of Ag, they've said, to their knowledge, there's never been any single crop that has created such interest and so many inquiries to their division as this particular item. So there are many possibilities. Senator Holland, through the chair, mentioned a few. There's thousands, literally thousands, and all kinds of experiments and things going on with different things. I know oil spill cleanups, things that are similar to plastics. You mentioned hempcrete, like concrete, so, and they're using for insulation. There's just a variety of things, and you know, let's open the door to this opportunity and get this statute updated. And with that, Buddy, he can explain, go over the sectional and explain some of the cleanup provisions that I didn't detail. And of course, we're available to answer your questions too.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. And Buddy, go ahead. Oh, Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is really fascinating to me, and I remember when Senator Ellis brought forward the bill with you. But my question is, so isn't hemp the same as a marijuana plant? Isn't hemp the marijuana plant itself?
Through the chair, Senator Gray Jackson, our Rob Carpenter with the Division of Elections that's a different Rob. Can explain in detail, but the less THC means it's not psychoactive, basically. So I don't know if the Madam Chair, if you'd want to have Rob answer that question, but they are sister plants, I believe.
So just for clarity, if I may, Madam Chair.
Senator Gray Jackson.
So a hemp plant looks the same as a marijuana plant. It's just a different type of marijuana plant. I mean, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. I just want, like I said, this is fascinating to me, and I just want to be clear on the difference between a marijuana plant and a hemp plant, or if it's the same species, if you will.
I'm not a botanist, and so I don't know, Buddy, if you want to try to answer that or if we want to bring Rob on the line.
At this point, I think what I'll just do is look to the will of the committee. We have two routes we could go. We could either have Buddy walk us through the sectional, or we could go to Rob Carter right now, who's the chief agronomist with the Alaska Division of Ag, to give us a little biology lesson. Which do you prefer?
Rob Carter, I think.
Okay.
I've heard enough from
Sorry, Buddy. We're going to go to Rob Carter. Rob, can you introduce yourself for the committee? And you heard the questions from Senator Gray Jackson and give us some background on what we're talking about here with hemp.
Well, good afternoon and thank you, committee. My name is Rob Carter and I'm with the State of Alaska Division of Agriculture here in Palmer. To answer a multitude of questions, industrial hemp is Cannabis sativa. That is the same genus and species as what you are referenced to as recreational cannabis or marijuana as a common name. That plant does look in sometimes very similar. Those two plants do. Traditionally, industrial hemp is grown in a solid stand, more traditionally like grain, like a barley or a wheat. Just imagine it 8 or 9 feet tall. So in reference, if you see an individual growing industrial hemp for something like cannabinoid production, it may look more similar to a recreational cannabis plant. Where grown for fiber, grain, or for biomass, for feed or fuel, it will look more like a traditional stand of corn, barley, wheat, just extremely tall. The leaf is the same. Botanically speaking, if you get into it, there's a significant amount of more herd, which is the material inside the plant, the fibrous material inside the plant, for us plant geeks that we look at. If you saw it, you would see the traditional cannabis leaf. But again, majority of the time, the methodology in actually producing the plant creates a more upright, lean look to it than you'd see in a traditional indoor grown recreational plant, because they are specifically growing for the floral material on top of the plant, and generally plants that are for fiber or biomass production are actually harvested well before flower. You would see that similar, longer, skinnier, narrow flower for someone that was growing for grain or for seed.
Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That clarifies my question perfectly. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens.
So Rob, help me understand. Now, we legalized marijuana in this state a couple of years ago. The public did. Do we also legalize the growing of marijuana?
For the record, this is Rob Carter. Through the chair, Senator Stevens, that is all regulated by the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Board, a completely different section than we are. They do regulate all aspects of the growth and production. The definitive characteristics of industrial hemp and what Senator Shelley Hughes has said is the 2014 Farm Bill identified industrial hemp or cannabis that tests below 0.3% Delta-9 THC as an industrial agriculture crop. And to reduce the burden on the producer and the processor for a crop that someone could not get inebriated on, they've assigned those abilities through states' departments of ag. We treat it very similar to we do a regulated potato or barley crop. We call those certified grass grain seeds.
So thank you, Rob. So what I was getting at is that you can legally grow, under the right conditions and permission, marijuana in this state. You can also, we're trying to arrange that people can grow hemp. And I guess the reason for the amendment is that there might be some fear that somebody growing hemp would actually get a seed that would allow greater THC in it. It doesn't seem to make much sense that you would not grow hemp, as you were talking about, for grain and attempt to sell it as hemp, as marijuana. So I guess I'm going around in a circle here, but I think I understand where we're going, and they're not the same thing and not controlled in the same way. So thank you, Rob.
You're welcome, sir.
Thank you, Rob. Let's see. Next, I think we'll go to Buddy for the walking us through the sectional, and we do have David Shade online, who's the director of the Division of Ag, and also we have an invited testimony from Sarah Williams, who's from an organization, Hemp for Healthcare. So with that, Buddy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Once again, my name is Buddy Witt. I'm staff to Senator Hughes. I'll just go through the sectional here real quick. Section 1 of the bill adds two subsections to AS 030501-10 alpha. These two subsections authorize the Department of Natural Resources to include the manufacturing and retail sales of products made from industrial hemp, as well as registration and renewal procedures and the regulations for the industrial hemp program that we will be talking about a little bit later. Section 2 of the bill adds language that a registrant for the industrial hemp program is not eligible if they have been convicted of felony involving a controlled substance within the last 10 years. This section also is added to comply with provisions of the 2018 Farm Bill. So this is a federal requirement that we have in statute in order to move forward with an industrial hemp program. The also allowed those who were growing the 2018 Farm Bill and the federal regulations that followed
also allowed for those who are growing industrial hemp prior to this federal requirement to be grandfathered in. And I do have a CFR reference for the committee that I'm happy to send if you require that. Section 3 of the bill adds that the department may develop an industrial hemp program that complies with federal requirements and submit a plan for the program to the United States Department of Agriculture for approval. The department may continue to run the industrial hemp pilot program until such time as a permanent industrial hemp program is in place to replace it. Seemed to be the most clear and seamless way to provide some transitional language in statute to go from the pilot program that we have now into a permanent hemp production program in the future. In Section 4, this is one of the cleanup provisions of the bill, Madam Chair, and I'm going to talk about this as well as the amendment that was just passed by the committee because they work in conjunction with each other. Currently, statutory language, which was passed in SB 6, outlines industrial hemp program guidelines, but they're somewhat incongruent with other sections of law. So AS 0305079 says that a grower may retain and condition their crop if it tests above 3% but below 1% THC. However, there's another piece of however, the statute currently says that once they test above 0.3% that they're guilty of a violation. This removes the guilty of the violation provision and simply allows someone who tests above 0.3% THC but below 1.0% THC the opportunity to recondition their crop. However, we added another section, as you can see in this section, that says if someone fails to recondition their crop, then they would be guilty of a violation. So again, a good actor acting in good faith would be given the opportunity. However, the Division of Agriculture would be allowed to issue a violation if they weren't acting in good faith or they didn't follow the protocols in place.
Thank you, Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Buddy, could you explain what reconditioning means? I've never been a farmer. I don't really know what that means. Is that keeping the plant around for a few years? Is that what we're talking about?
Thank you. Through the chair, Buddy Witt, again, Senator Stevens, I could attempt to, but we have an expert on the line who I think would be doing a much better job than I could, sir, and that would be Mr. Carter.
Yes, I'm gathering it would be Mr. Carter. Rob, did you hear the question?
Yes, Madam Chair. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you great.
Had a goofy glitch on the phone. For the record, this is Rob Carter. Senator, a reconditioning is a process that we use quite regularly in agriculture where we have a lot of a specific material, albeit that seed or industrial hemp, that may not be or is borderline on in violation of a regulation. It could be an inert material, such as too many sticks and seeds. It could be another crop, and in this case it is a Delta 9 THC concentration above 0.3 but below 1%. This would allow an individual farmer that, let's say, had two or three different fields of industrial hemp, if one of those fields tested at 0.31 or 0.33, they could then retain that material and then blend it to another lot of industrial hemp that was below the 0.3%, let's say 0.21. And then as a resample and retest made that whole lot below 0.3%, it could then be moved into commerce and the individual farmer would not have to destroy a portion of a crop because of a tenth of a percent. If you have any further questions.
Senator Stevens, did you have any follow-up?
Yes, I do. Since we have you here, thank you, Rob. I mean, if you were growing just a regular crop of wheat or corn or whatever, you wouldn't have to go all through all these gyrations. But a farmer who chooses to do industrial hemp has to do registration and renewal, has to do a plan for the program, has to deal with reconditioning. Aren't we asking a lot more of the farmers than we would do if they were just doing wheat?
For the record, this is Rob Carter. If it was a traditional wheat crop, yes, we would be. The 2014 and 2018 Farm Bill have given us some very specific federal guidelines on what they require, and I think this is to provide a sense of security for many that don't understand the botanical difference between industrial hemp and recreational cannabis because they are the same genus and species. But if you look at something similar to certified seed of potato production or a certified wheat crop, those individuals would also have to apply, have their fields inspected, and meet some very rigorous testings to be able to use those defined words to sell it at that level. So yes, it is a little more onerous than that, but we are trying our best to follow the federal guidelines and provide Alaska's agricultural industry this new one because we were in production last year and had industrial hemp produced in the state, a legal avenue to do such.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate your explanation, and that's for those who don't understand basic botany. Thank you.
Thank you, and I want to mention that we've been joined by Senator Rivak. Welcome.
Thank you.
I was curious, Senator Hughes or Buddy, did you contemplate at all how you would handle or how the bill would handle folks who had repeated violations, or are we addressing this as if there really are no intentional violators out there?
I can take a crack at it.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Through the chair, Buddy Witt again. In discussions with the Division of Agriculture, and they've been doing this for a year, and they can speak more to what they found with testing. So far, the testing has been very positive. It's been well below the benchmark of 0.3%. As of yet, there's no evidence that would make the bill sponsor that I know of be anything less than confident that we can do this, and that of bad actors there would be few, if any. But I don't want to take words out of her mouth. And Rob Carter can speak more to what they found in their testing regimen so far. To answer your question more specifically, Madam Chair, is having the USDA stamp of approval on an industrial hemp program helps the state out immensely. In order to have that USDA stamp of approval, there have to be certain guidelines that the state has to meet statutorily, and this bill attempts to do that. To what Senator Stevens was speaking to earlier, yes, there are a lot more regulatory and statutory guidelines on someone who produces hemp than there would be on someone who produces seed potatoes or corn or some other sort of crop. However, none of those other crops have the potential of becoming a high THC type of product. So I believe that there still is, in the day and age we live in, the need to not only fit in with federal guidelines, but provide specific regulatory and statutory guidelines for growers so that it's understood from everyone that there are differences in the plant, and while we treat them differently, we need to make sure people understand the potential and make sure we're protecting the state and our communities from bad actors if they are out there. I don't know if that answered your question.
Thank you. Rob, this is Senator Costello, and I know that disease-free seed potatoes are exported, and the fact that they're disease-free is a pretty significant status. And from what Buddy just said, it sounds like we are saying that industrial hemp actually has more hoops to jump through. Is industrial hemp, are these products going to be exported from Alaska? And can you just give the committee a brief overview of what kind of products you've seen coming out of the state so far? What are the different farmers producing or using their hemp, industrial hemp for?
For the record, Madam Chair, this is Rob Carter with the Division of Agriculture. I will fall back on one thing Buddy referenced that I think is very appropriate for this conversation. In 2020 production season, which we all know was a very unique year for us to roll out a program, We had 70 acres of industrial hemp produced in the state of Alaska. To put that in comparison, that's about as twice as many carrot acres as that we have in the state. Of that, 9,000 square feet was indoor grown. We, under our regulatory authority for industrial hemp, to provide safety to not only the consumers, the farmers, the retailers, and the processors, we actually physically sample each individual field lot. And all of the tests for 2020 came back at less than half of what the federal legal limit is for THC. So we were in the 0.15, 0.16 percent THC level of that. And I think that's outstanding. It's better than any state in the country at this point. And so we did not and did not expect to have any what the industry calls a hot crop or above that 0.3% delta 9 THC. For products coming out, we will see these products exported. Alaska is known for its clean water and its clean soil, and there is a huge interest around the world for industrial hemp derivatives. We have seen in our first year, I will tell you, was a trial year for most of our farmers, including us here at the Plant Material Center at the Division of Ag. We were identifying what varieties did well at what. We have seen interest in grain, not only for human consumption, but for animal consumption. We've seen interest in fiber for biomass, and that's for experimental fuel sources, for fiber for things such as hempcrete. Unique enough, insulation is one that's moving along now pretty heavily, as well as fiber bond, like the door panel of your car. In addition to that, there's a lot of cannabinoid use for extraction of the non-psychoactive cannabinoids that people use for wellness. Generally, those are incorporated to anything from shampoo and conditioner to salves and lotion. And so that is really where we're seeing things in the U.S. 2020 was about a $20 billion year industry for industrial hemp and industrial hemp products. I think the ends or the use and use of this are pretty much endless at this point. We've been lacking a little bit of research for the last 70 years on industrial hemp, but it is a very unique crop, and there is a massive interest from a lot of industries, like I said, from things such as biomass for fuel sources to bioplastics.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate your answer to my question. Are there other questions of committee members? Okay, seeing none. Thank you, Rob. I appreciate you being online for questions. I would like to now invite Sarah Williams with an organization, Hemp for Healthcare, to provide invited testimony. Oh, I thought we did.
Thank you. Are we there? Oh.
Hey, Sarah?
Yes?
I think I jumped the gun a little bit here. If you could wait while we actually allow Buddy to finish the sectional, that would be great. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Buddy Witt, and I'll be quick. We were on Section 4 and 5 of the bill, which removes in Section 4 removes is guilty of a violation, and instead puts it in Section 5, which says if an individual retains a crop that tests above the benchmarks but fails to recondition, then they will be guilty of a violation. When we worked with the department on this language. And this coincides with the amendment that was passed by the committee, which, again, allows takes away the prohibitive language that is in there and allows a may for the department to issue a stop sale order if there is a bad actor that is recognized, instead of assuming that all people who are growing the crop, if they test above 0.3, are bad actors. We're not going to make that assumption. We're going to allow the department and really the experts on the crop to make those determinations. Section 6 of the bill changes the definition of industrial hemp to match the federal definition, which was changed in the 2018 Farm Bill. And then the last three of the sections of the bill have to do with repealers and conditional effect language. What these sections in conjunction, of course, Section 7, as you can see, repeals AS 0305077, which is the section that deals with an industrial hemp program. But that will stay in place, but only be repealed once the USDA has approved an industrial hemp program. That is that conditional effect language. So that repealer will be in effect once The state of Alaska has received the green light on an industrial hemp program from the USDA. And then there is additional guidance in Section 9 of how that conditional effective language is put into place. The effective date of Section 7 takes place once the reviser of statutes has received notice from the commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. So as it stands now, this allows the Division of Agriculture to continue to do the research and the growing of industrial hemp under a pilot program while also working on the regulations and the plan for a long-term industrial hemp program, send it to the USDA, and once the USDA has approved it and the Department of Natural Resources has received notice of that approval, then Section 7 of the bill will take effect. The hemp pilot program will go away, and Alaska would operate under the hemp program as approved by the USDA. And that, Madam Chair, is all I have.
All right, thank you. Sarah, if you could introduce yourself for the committee and provide your testimony, please.
Absolutely. Thank you. My name is Sarah Williams, and I live here in Wasilla, and I am the founder of Hemp for Healthcare in Alaska. Greeting honorable senators and staff. Greetings, Senator Shelley Hughes. Thank you so much for being the innovator and pioneer on this, and hello to everyone. Today, I am testifying in favor of 99% of SB 27, and so thank you for hearing my testimony. As a couple of you know, I am affectionately known as the Hemp Lady in some circles around the Capitol because of my unfailing passion for the hemp plant and the vision of a hemp-based economy for Alaska. Every Saturday morning at 9 a.m., I broadcast explaining hemp across all of my social media platforms to an accumulated audience of 25,000 global citizens, where, as I like to say, we discuss a new hemp-tastic topic every week. So the first 7 weeks of 2021, we discussed hemp as paper, hemp as medicine, plastics, textiles, fuel and energy, building materials, and even we touched on it as a food crop. Then we've moved now into how to grow it, harvest it, process it. And this coming weekend, we'll discuss the equipment that's used to process hemp to get a clearer picture of the many types of equipment that are used in the hemp processing space. For the past 6 years, I've been heavily involved in the development and execution of both the Alaskan cannabis and hemp industries in both the public and private arenas. I've served as the chair of the Marijuana Advisory Committee for the Mat-Su Borough, where we created regulations for retail and cultivation cannabis facilities. And I've also helped 7 marijuana licensees complete the application process and become licensed. But that's enough about me. Today is about hemp and the people of Alaska. As we get started, I wanted to discuss what I do not support about SB 27. This bill is 99% excellent and much needed for the Alaskan people. However, Section 2, AS03.05.076A, on page 3, lines 9 through 24, needs to be greatly modified, if not removed entirely. Hemp is an agricultural crop. It is a food and fiber crop, as well as a medicinal crop. The many uses for hemp make it a versatile crop, and therefore we must abolish this system, this belief system, that because a human being has made a mistake in judgment, that once convicted of a felony, they cannot now contribute to the economy of Alaska and grow or manufacture hemp for food or fiber. So in the attached document that I gave you guys and prepared for you today is a proposed language change that creates a compromise. Although I strongly recommend a complete abolishment of this section and stop the exclusion of those with a criminal history from the industry and the giving back to Alaska's economy, I'm willing to be understanding of compromise. Additionally, the recreational cannabis industry has a 5-year exclusion for a misdemeanor involving a controlled substance, not a 10-year exclusion. And this is absolutely excessive. And frankly, my opinion creates barriers to entry that make no sense to an enlightened species that wants to give their people the best chance for an improved life. One last topic that I didn't put in my original document, but that I wanted to mention quickly, is Delta-8 tetrahydrocannabinol. This is something that's not mentioned in the federal bill, and it's not something that's really known except recently we've come to realize that it has very similar psychoactive properties to that of Delta-9 tetrahydrocannabidiol. And so with that, there's no limitation on it. There's no understanding of it as being psychoactive or anything within legislation that says, hey, pay attention to Delta-8. And so what we've seen is actually some individuals in the Alaskan hemp industry put Delta-8 within their CBD products, and those individuals experience psychoactive experiences. And then when they go to buy other CBD products and do not experience a psychoactive experience, they don't quite understand what's going on. And so it's something that could be easily done by adding the word Delta-8 tetrahydrocannabidiol to section 03.05.079. So now moving on to how hemp will improve Alaska's economy. My vision is for an Alaskan hemp industry that fuels our economy and provides all we need for our people. For too long, Alaska has depended on the outside world to take care of her. And the hemp industry and the thousands of products that hemp can make gives Alaska an opportunity to build an industry that can sustain her no matter what is going on outside of her borders. The versatility of the hemp plant and its many uses can create thousands of jobs in sectors from labor-type jobs to highly skilled, and can add well over $703 million to our economic capability. And I'm confident that this is a low number. In my testimony packet, I've added some calculations and documents that have come from my network that I've built over the past 6 years of hemp growers in the lower 48 and globally that have come together around my hemp for healthcare concept. I want to see Alaska have a successful hemp industry. The hemp for healthcare idea is simple. We grow hemp, tax the biomass sales, and put that money into a healthcare fund, untouchable by other needs of society. Then we process that hemp into thousands of different products Alaskans need and sell it on hempforhealthcare.com for drop shipment all over the state, as well as in brick-and-mortar branded stores, to then take the profits generated and put them into the healthcare fund that creates a single-payer healthcare system for all Alaskan residents.
Sarah, if you could keep to the material in the bill, that would be wonderful. Thank you.
Oh, I understand. Okay. So there are two other parts to it. So you've got the rest of this. So with the point of what is left on this, really where we have to begin is in the processing of it. And last spring, my team spent days calling farmers across the state of Alaska, asking them to grow hemp to support our initiative. And they loved the idea, but the question was the same. Where are we going to process it? And so my team switched strategies, and we began to work on a processing plant that could process things that came off the fields into usable commodities. We've been working on a number of processing plant opportunities, and the opportunity for Alaska to create jobs with this is tremendous. Each processing project can bring anywhere from 20 to 350 new jobs to Alaska, but that doesn't include the other businesses that will partner with the processing plants for their end products, as well as transportation, farmers, laborers to grow the hemp for processing. So I thank the Lord Christ Jesus, who has given me strength to do his work in this process. And I need your support in Alaska in each hemp. So I thank you for voting yes on Senate Bill 27. But first, amending out the exclusion for felony. And please reach out if you have any questions. I'll be happy to use my network to answer them for you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Sarah, for your testimony. Senator Stevens.
Thank you. I actually question of Buddy.
Oh, okay. The question is for Buddy. Senator Stevens.
So in looking at Section 2, I understand what Ms. Williams is saying, but and I sort of agree with the issue about exclusion of felons, but isn't this a requirement of the federal government, that the reason Section 2 is in there? Buddy, could you explain that if we want to grow hemp in the state of Alaska, we've got to comply with the federal government, and Section 2 is necessary to do that?
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Stevens, Buddy Witt for the record. That is correct, sir. That is a requirement of federal law, and that is found in 7 CFR 990.6 Echo 1. And the bill sponsor would be happy to change that if we could, but until the federal government decides that that's no longer a requirement, it has to be in our state law. Otherwise, the USDA would not approve an industrial hemp program.
Well, thank you, Eddie. So if I understand it, I mean, this may be offensive to some people, but if we were to take it out, we would never be able to get the federal approval to grow hemp in Alaska. Is that right?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, Buddy Witt for the record, that is my understanding. However, Senator, we would be happy to go back, get that in writing, and present it to the committee.
I think that'd be really valuable.
Okay. Thank you very much, Senator Hughes. Did you have any final comments before we move on to the final bill on today's calendar?
Yeah, I want to thank you very much. And I know David Shade is online, the Division of Ag Director, and I know he's been pretty excited about this program. If you can permit a minute or so for him to say something, I'd kind of like to hear what he has to say myself, but if you don't have time, that's understandable.
Are there any questions of Mr. Shade? Does the committee wish to hear from him? Yep. All right, David, if you'd like to give a few comments on the bill.
Yes, Madam Chairman. My name is David Shady, S-C-H-A-D-E. I am the director of the Division of Agriculture. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you fine.
Okay, so, you know, we really appreciate Senator Hughes and Buddy's work on this. This is something that we have been working on since I've been the director for the last 2 years. So, as Rob has eloquently explained, the pilot program is moving along quite well. We have 117 retail registrations, a number of farmers, and it continues to go forward. So a couple of things to answer questions that maybe didn't get fully answered. One, we always have to acknowledge that while marijuana, or as we say internally, recreational cannabis, is legal in Alaska, it is still federally illegal. And so that always puts the state program in a bit of a bind when you're dealing and you're trying to draw the very finite line. So this is very important for us to keep us, the state, within the federal guidelines, because we then have the opportunities to operate on a national and international basis. One of the keys of the 2018 Farm Bill is that no state can restrict the transportation of industrial hemp. And so that is a huge issue in a lot of the lower 48. So, you know, we're working very hard to get within the federal guidelines so that this industry, and we're working on both a national and an international basis. As we discussed, a federal felony, 10 years, is a federal requirement of the 2018 Farm Bill, and one reason why we had to ask for a delay on doing a plan, because we could not, under Alaska law, apply and get accepted, our plan accepted. So through the state and through the National Association of State Departments of Agriculture, we got a one-year delay in the sunsetting of our pilot program. The last question that I heard out there is, what happens if we have a bad actor? And because this industrial hemp is a regulated crop, you have to be registered either under the USDA program or the state's program. And so if there are failures to follow the guidelines, then they won't be registered and they will be out of business. So happy to answer any other questions the committee might have.
Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, David. So you agree that it would be wrong for us to remove Section 2 because that would put us out of compliance with the federal government and we couldn't grow hemp in Alaska anyway. Is that true?
That is absolutely correct, Senator Stevens, through the chair. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator Hughes and Buddy, for introduction of Senate Bill 27, and we will be holding this bill for further consideration. Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Next on our agenda is Senate Bill 87. It's a Senate Rules Committee bill introduced by request of the governor. It's an act relating to credit for reinsurance. It's the first hearing in Labor and Commerce, and welcome Lori Winghier, the Division Director for Insurance, Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. Appreciate you being here to introduce the bill for the committee members.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I thank the members of the committee for taking time today to talk to me about a bill that is not nearly as exciting as SB 27 that you just heard. I thought if it was okay, Madam Chair, I'd talk a little bit about how we got where we're at with this. As a state of Alaska, we are members of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, the NAIC, and that is all the states, the territories, and the District of Columbia. And our insurance products, of course, it's a financial industry, it's heavily regulated, and when we look at examinations of insurance companies, what we have agreed to as the NAIC is we put out our own standards for accreditation, meaning that when my team goes in to look at Alaska National or UMALIC that are domiciled here, we use the same standards that Rhode Island uses, or Florida uses, or California. So when Alaska National goes to California, that commissioner or director can know that that company is being looked at identically to how they would look at their own. What that saves is that the insurance companies that are doing multi-state business are not being audited or examined by every state. They're being examined by one, we share the results, they have to trust my judgment or my work, the work of my team, as I trust theirs. For that accreditation, we are examined ourselves, and our accreditation is renewed if we pass. They come in, literally come into the division, pull our files, and go through our paperwork to see that what we have done in examinations meets the standards of the NAIC. Now, let's take that a step further. And we're finding reinsurance. And we're finding that companies who do your primary insurance, be it your homeowners or commercial insurance, they put up the front policy, the primary insurance. And then to some degree, some level, they're going to buy insurance behind that. Or they may buy insurance, let's say that State Farm, and I'm just making this up, but State Farm gives you a whole homeowners, but they sell you earthquake, and they're going to reinsure that earthquake peril. What this bill is doing is now looking at the world and where reinsurance is coming from. The federal government, through Dodd-Frank, established the Federal Insurance Office. The Federal Insurance Office created what we call the covered agreement. The first one was with the European Union. The second one was with the United Kingdom. And what they're saying is we're taking the same accreditation standards and applying them in the European Union and the United Kingdom so that when we have reinsurance come over here or a company buys reinsurance from a company that's domiciled in Europe or the United Kingdom, they're being measured or on an accredited standard as if they were domiciled here. Conversely, when our companies go over to sell reinsurance to a European risk, the European communities can trust that those companies are financially solvent and have been looked at. That is the kind of, in a nutshell, what this is, credit for reinsurance, as to how much credit we can say to an insurance company when we look at their financials and they tell us what they have ceded to a reinsurance company, how we can look at their financials and what they have on their books as far as underwriting. Because for everything they write, we have to see that there's capital, we have to see that there's solvency, we have to see that there's a ratio to make sure they can pay the claim of all the consumers in Alaska. What this bill is doing, even though it looks like a rather long bill, it actually kind of starts on page 10, and it's adding a section of what a qualified reinsurer must do to assume the liabilities of an insurer domiciled in Alaska. It must have its head office or be domiciled in a reciprocal jurisdiction, which is defined at the end of the bill, have and maintain capital and surplus or its equivalent in an amount set out by the legislature in regulation, have and maintain a solvency or capital ratio in an amount set out in regulation, and agree to provide adequate assurances to my office, and they are detailed in the bill. Provide documentation that I might require. Maintain a practice of prompt payment of claims, which would be to the primary insurer, and confirm to the director on an annual basis that they are in compliance with all our statutes. That is section one of the bill, and again, it begins on page 10, but it's just the way it falls into the statutes that we have to get there. Section two is just adding words to clarify certain words to deed to reflect compliance now that we have added the A6. Section three defines what a reciprocal jurisdiction is, and it talks about if it's a non-U.S. company or if it's a U.S. company, and that they must meet the certain standards to be a reciprocal jurisdiction. Section four is amended, requiring the director to consider the list of reciprocal jurisdictions published by the NAIC. Those right now, Bermuda, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, there's not very many of them. It's a pretty short list at this point. And finally, the bill allows me to develop regulations if I were to need them. And that, in essence, Madam Chair, is the bill that is before you, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Lori. Appreciate you introducing this bill to the committee. It's always a pleasure to have you before Labor and Commerce. Okay. I see no questions of committee members except for Senator Stevens.
Well, it is good to see Lori, but she always has very complicated bills. Now, this bill will only go to Labor and Commerce, is that right?
Senator Stevens, I see Labor and Commerce right here, and unless you want to add something.
No, I don't want to add anything, but I'm just saying that
I don't have that power.
that we really need to understand this because it's only going to us.
Yes, through the chair, this bill only has a referral to Labor and Commerce on the Senate.
Thank you.
So, Senator Stevens, I just wanted to mention here that the National Association of Insurance Credit or Insurance Commissioners is an organization. I'm somewhat familiar with them, and so it gives me a level of insurance, no pun intended, that when we see bills that have come out of this organization, we are vetting this here in Alaska, but it also, I'm sure, has been vetted elsewhere. And Lori, do you want to mention which other state legislatures have actually passed similar legislation? And what happens if a state decides to amend or change the legislation that's before them? Does it affect the other jurisdictions?
Madam Chair, we agree. To your point, this bill comes about much like you pass a bill. It starts up through a committee. It's debated. We take public testimony at the NAIC. We talk amongst ourselves of what's good and bad, hammer out the details, and then it's taken to plenary. This last, what I'm bringing to you today, passed unanimously in 2017. In 2017, which means that in theory, I need to have this done by September 2022, or we face federal preemption by the federal government, the Federal Insurance Office. This bill, I think I'm losing track of what you asked me. I'm sorry about that. But it has been vetted, and we do have this bill to save us from preemption. It has to be passed by September 2022. We did have this bill up in several states last year, but with COVID, most legislators adjourned early. And so I'm now seeing that I think it's passed in six states. And I know that the majority of the other states have it up because they're kind of like me. We know that it's coming quick. I believe in your materials that we gave you a memo that had a map of the states that showed where it was as far as what states had passed it. I know California, Virginia, and a couple others, and it is, when I checked a week or so ago, I think it's up in 18 other states. Vermont, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Mississippi, and California have adopted it. There's an open bill in Idaho, Kansas, Iowa, New York, Rhode Island, West Virginia, and Florida when we left in 2020.
Thank you, Lori. And I think what I'd like to do with this legislation is Senator Stevens does bring up a really important point. I'd like to ask that you make appointments with all of the members on the committee. And any questions that you receive from the members, if you could jot them down and then provide my office with written answers, just so that we have the assurance that that the committee members have had the time and the ability to review this bill if they have any questions. And then what I'll do is I'll have my staff go around to the offices and see if members are feeling comfortable, and we'll have a second hearing at that point with the public testimony.
Okay.
And I think that would be a good way to thoroughly look at this bill. We do only have a little more than 10 minutes today. Are there questions of committee members? Okay, seeing none, thank you, Lori. And just before you leave, if you could share with us how long you've been the director of insurance, and what did you do prior to that?
I was with Marsh McLennan for 16 years in downtown Anchorage. It was Brady and Company when I hired in. I was the corporate risk manager at Arctic Slope for 10 years, and I have been the director of the Division of Insurance now. I started in 2014 under Governor Parnell.
And are there other bills that came through the this organization that have passed the legislature?
Other bills that
Came through the NAIC?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Yes. Most of the bills I bring to you have been vetted at the NAIC. We very much try to follow, particularly because insurance companies don't licensing. They don't want have to comply with 56 jurisdictions on licensing, on accreditation, on the things that we look, claims processing, underwriting, when we look at discrimination and the good and the bad of insurance companies and things we look to, we try to keep our regulations and our statutes from one state to another, maybe a slight difference to address a local concern or something that is relevant to Alaska and nowhere else. Such as in Alaska, we have pretty stringent regulations on how you can adjust an auto claim. Because if you look at a blue book, and often, when you go to look at a value of a car that has been damaged, a 2020 Nissan in Idaho, the value of it in that same car in Barrow or Upteagavik, it's a totally different game. And so we want to make sure that our consumers are taken care of. And when there are things like that, we're taking into account the impact in Alaska to consumers.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Lori. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you for having me.
That concludes today's meeting. Our next meeting will be Wednesday, March 10th at 1:30. We will consider Senate Bill 9, the Alcohol Beverage Control Title IV rewrite. We will take public testimony on that bill. We will look at Senate Bill 88, the Governor's State Insurance Catastrophe Reserve Account introduced by the Rules Committee. And Senate Bill 11, Senator Begich's Community Property Trust, in addition to bills previously heard. So with that, at 2:50, the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee is adjourned.